So welcome all guests as well as employees here, and welcome to Microsoft's Development Center Copenhagen, which is also known as MDCC. I'm Michael Nielsen, and I'm hosting our guests here today. I've been a developer here for 25 years, and being a developer here is king, so going to hear a lot more about that. So here on campus, we are actually the biggest development center in Europe for Microsoft. We are over 600 developers, and we specialize in ERP or business solutions, and we are carrying the Dynamics products called AX, NAV, and C5 that you might have heard of, at least the people who are here who are doing this as their everyday work. So today we are doing a tech talk, and this is a series of talks we have with very technical people from Microsoft, and if you want to hear more about coming tech talks, you can visit mdcc.dk or look at our Facebook profile. So here in Microsoft, we focus really on having people to do and continue what they're doing best. Among others, that means that you don't have to be a man or lead thousands of people to get to the top of the company, but you can keep creating software as a developer and still be able to make it and be one of the most influential people in the company. In Microsoft, we have around 50,000 developers, and they're damn good developers. But we have a special category, and 20 of those are called technical fellows, and our guest here today is Mark Ehrenberg, who is one of them. So Mark is on the top, and he earned that through being a developer and being a damn good one. Actually, Mike did a lot of stuff before he joined Microsoft, and he worked on an invention that all of you use every week, I think. He worked on the initial ATM, or the Dancort Automate from Olivetti. And Mark told me that he did the thing that gives him the money, so it's the most important piece. So you can think about him every time you do that, because it's a fantastic invention. And you can also do banking at after midnight and don't have to, at least in Denmark, be there before 4. I've known Mark since he joined Microsoft back 8 years ago, and I initially discovered that he's a Red Sox fan. And for those of you who don't know, it's a baseball team in Boston, a really famous one. So I also learned that when he talks about the Green Monster or the Bambino Curse, he's not crazy, but that's actually something really important if you're into that kind of game. Mark is also a road racer. He likes really to ride his bike up steep mountains, and I'm convinced that he would have a fair chance in winning Tour de France if he had the time. Fortunately for us, he's doing more important stuff with Microsoft, but he's really keen on riding his bike and damn good at it. When Mike joined us, he immediately specialized in cloud computing or service-oriented architecture, it was called back then. And today he will share his knowledge about what to be aware of when architecting for the cloud. And I'm really looking forward to hear Mark's view on the subject over the next hour. So please welcome Mark Ehrenberg.
Thanks, King Michael. Appreciate the introduction. It's great to be here this morning. I guess if I'd read the paper before I left, I could have just stayed at home and done this through Skype, but just a test to see who's been reading the paper this morning. Okay, so what we're going to do today is talk a bit about kind of the things we think about in terms of how we will evolve our software to architect for the cloud. And most of the things that I'll talk about will be generally applicable for building cloud-based software, but we'll, in general, take a very specific focus on business applications and what that means for Dynamics. And it's really one of the things that's unique about doing this at Microsoft is we will not achieve the transition to the cloud entirely by changing the platform software or entirely by changing the application software. This kind of generational change in technology only happens when we can change both pieces together. And our ability as the Dynamics team to influence what happens with the Microsoft platform for the cloud, specifically Windows Azure, SQL Azure, and the Azure App Fabric, is an incredible opportunity for us in terms of producing kind of the next generation of business application software. Talking about the cloud is kind of a new conversation for ERP, but it's not a new conversation for Microsoft, and it's not a new conversation for Microsoft Dynamics. Microsoft, between MSN, Bing, Hotmail, Xbox Live, and if anybody doesn't recognize the other one that's up there, that's Windows Update, builds some of the largest services that run at scale. If you look at Windows Update and look at the statistics on the number of petabytes of data that move through that service every month, the number of machines that get touched by that service every month, if you look at things like Xbox Live, where it's not unusual for me to walk downstairs in my house and see my son playing soccer. He's also a baseball fan, but he's a soccer player. Playing soccer against a couple of his friends where he used to live in Boston and a couple of guys in Europe that he's never met. And the game doesn't look any different than if they were all playing in the same room. Right? It's really a pretty incredible service. And so Microsoft has a tremendous experience with how to deliver services that run at scale in the cloud. But within Dynamics, and it's important to think about here because it's a product we deal with more in Redmond. But with Microsoft Dynamics CRM Online, we have a great example of what matters for cloud-based software for business applications. And you'll hear as I go through things a number of things where we'll be doing things now with ERP that we've already succeeded in doing once with CRM. And so it's great to, you know, it's one thing to have smart people look at a hard problem. They'll figure out something. But smart people who can cheat because they've already looked at the problem before get to the right solution faster. And so our experience with CRM is a great place for us to build from as we look forward to the work we're doing today with ERP. One of the things that's really important for me when we think about the cloud is really, before we talk about any of the technology, is to really focus on what it is that the customer wants and what's driving the customer to the cloud. Because if we don't achieve what they're after, then it really doesn't matter how elegant the technology is. We won't have done what we need to do. And so kind of a number of the things that our customers look for as they think about bringing application solutions to the cloud. Number one is they want to be out of the infrastructure business. And what does that mean? They don't want to run their hardware infrastructure. But maybe more importantly, they want to not necessarily have to figure out up front how big to size that infrastructure. They don't want to be in the business of upgrading that infrastructure over time. They really want us to take on that responsibility. The second thing is it's a shift in the way that they want to pay for their business applications or for any of the solutions that they put in the cloud. Instead of looking at it as a solution that you pay for up front, with a license cost and then maybe ongoing maintenance, they really want to treat it very differently, as if it's a service or a utility that you subscribe to and pay for by the month. Right? And so it's important as we build the solution, it's more than just the technology, it's the way we address licensing and the whole way in which we make those services available to our customers. The next thing, which is really kind of very unique, is the idea that the cloud provides what we call elastic IT capacity. There's capacity there if you need it, and it's not there if you don't need it. And really, this is the idea of a customer being able to pay for what they use, for what they need, and not having to buy one system up front. If you think about most businesses that we deal with, maybe a retailer, they will have a huge peak around the holidays. If they're running their software on-premise, they have to buy hardware and buy infrastructure and have it all the time just based on that peak that they need at the holidays. For other businesses, they may have one job that runs once a month that requires an enormous amount of CPU. They have to have that all the time, and they have to pay for it all the time. In the cloud, that doesn't apply. If we do things correctly, the capacity is there, and as they use it, we keep track of what they're using, and they pay for what they use. And when it's not peak time, they're not paying the extra load. We always talk about this, about peaks, but it's also a case of what happens when a business grows, or the one that nobody wants to talk about is what happens when a business shrinks. When a customer adds users, they should just want to pay a little bit more for the additional users. They shouldn't have to resize their entire infrastructure to run it. If they shrink their business, they should be able to pay less for their IT capacity, and that's an important part of our cloud architecture. The other thing that's really important is, we always talk at Microsoft about building solutions that have high value, or we usually talk in terms of delivering great value at low total cost of ownership. One of the things that's changed in the cloud is that that's still very important, but the time to value is perhaps more important today. And this is really a combination of the cloud and also the way the economy has changed the way people think about how they spend money. When we talk about time to value, what we mean is what is the amount of time from the moment that somebody starts to think about working with one of our applications or buying one of our applications till it's installed and running and they're actually getting value back to their business, right? So from the moment that they start the project, how much time goes by before they're actually getting value in their business from that software? And the cloud is an enormous accelerator to how quickly they can get started getting value back. If people have not tried to set up your own Dynamics CRM online environment, I suggest that you try it. I suggest that you not all try it at once because we don't want to put a huge stress on the infrastructure, but it's really a pretty amazing experience. You go through three screens. You need very little beyond a live ID and an imaginary name for your company. But three screens, probably the hardest thing that you'll have to do is there's one of those little kind of drawings of characters that you have to figure out what they really say and type it back in. That's probably the hardest part of the process to get that right. And maybe that's just because I'm old, which Michael said in a nicer way. But I honestly do believe it's, I frequently will do that in an EBC right in front of the customer, is we'll actually go sign up for a new CRM site for them and provision it. It's three screens, it's 2 minutes, 95% of the time it's done within 2 minutes, and you have an instance of CRM up and running. So sort of the first aspect of time to value is I went from nothing in 2 minutes to actually having a business application running. And we expect to achieve the same thing on the ERP side. Or at least in the same scale, minutes. And if you compare that to what somebody would do today with an on-premise product of having to order hardware, figuring out what hardware to order, figuring out what software to order, get all of that, get it all installed, we've taken days or weeks or in some cases with larger companies months out of that time to value picture. But that's not all. When you get your site provision, you don't get a CRM application with an empty screen. You get an application that's got sample data loaded in it, that comes right up to an executive desktop that's got charts and shows you through something we call a help visor how to get started immediately using the application. So time to value goes beyond just the part that we can save in the cloud by getting the system up and running. But how quickly can we get the user engaged and implemented and starting to use the system? And we're doing a lot of very exciting work around that as well. The next thing is, and this really kind of affects more than architecture for how we build software, but process for how we build software as well, is that in the cloud, the customer is generally expecting a more rapid innovation cycle. They're not looking for a 3-year release cycle that we typically have in the on-premise world. Arguably with their business application, maybe it's okay if the Bing homepage changes every 3 days. They're not looking for that either. But there's a big window between 3 days and 3 years. And so they're looking for a much more rapid release cycle, as well as having those releases happen without a difficult upgrade process. And again, I think it's great to look at what we've already been through with our CRM product online to understand that it's possible and to understand what has to happen both from a process point of view and a tools point of view and a ongoing sustainability point of view to make those kind of commitments. Recently, when we introduced Dynamics CRM 2011 online, here's what happens. That new version of the service goes into production, and all new customers that sign up immediately start using the new service. We run that way for a few months, and once we have confidence in the new service with new customers, we start to notify existing customers that they're going to be upgraded between a particular date window. You will be upgraded between May 15th and May 29th. And the customers actually get the opportunity to tell us, no, that's actually not a good that's not a good time for me. That's my busiest 2 weeks of the year. Please don't touch my software. I would like to defer that. And we actually allow them to defer for up to a year. And so if you think about that, then we will be running in our data centers multiple versions of the application because customers can stay on the existing one for up to a year. But the ones that do agree to be upgraded, they're automatically upgraded. There's no time where somebody sits down with the partner and goes through the code and sees what needs to be changed, et cetera. All the customization has now been done in a way that we can silently and seamlessly upgrade that. We also change the way in which we do the upgrade of the data. You know, with some of our ERP systems, with the larger ones, the Dynamics AX, we focus on getting the database upgrade done within a number of hours. That's not what happens in the online environment. In the cloud environment, we upgrade in parallel, and there's a almost instantaneous switchover from old version to new version. And that's sort of the expectation that the customers have in the cloud, and it will change the way in which we address the upgrade process. I think the next thing that we're really looking at, which again goes beyond sort of how we build the software itself, is bringing some of the best practices of our IT practices of our best customers to all of our customers. And so, for example, one of the things that our best customers do is that they have a separate environment that they do their development in. And the ones we like to talk about also have an environment where they test that work. And finally, they roll that out to production. I know the other ones exist. I've gotten the phone call when somebody decided maybe it was a good idea to change something in the live production system. But our best customers sort of follow an application life cycle that formalizes development, test, and production. And in the cloud, we have the unique ability to make that accessible to everybody, because the capacity's there, right? And the capacity's there that we can make it easy for them to have those separate instances, and we can provide the tools and the process to help them move their changes in an orderly way between development, test, and production, and use the same tools that we have for workflow to help them formalize those workflows as well. And so we will do a lot of work on what we call the application lifecycle around our products, in order to bring those best practices of our best customers to everyone. I think, you know, this and among a number of the other things that I'm talking about, while we're not the first to bring ERP to the cloud, we have the opportunity to do it differently and produce solutions that are truly different from the ones that we compete with, and this is clearly one of those areas. And then the last thing, which I'll talk about at the end of the session, is we're going to focus this morning on what do we have to do with our software, our core applications, the ones we've known and worked on for a long time. What do we have to do differently to bring those to the cloud? But the thing that we should all think about is that the cloud actually makes certain things possible that just simply weren't practical or possible before. And we'll talk about those scenarios and how to think more broadly about how we can help businesses through software in the cloud environment. One of the last things that I'll talk about, and it will be a big focus of what we do, is in addition to sort of taking a product like Dynamics AX or Dynamics NAV and making it run in the cloud, there's a whole experience around that. And we've talked a little bit about it already this morning. From the time, what does a customer see when they sign up? What is that experience like? How quickly do they get started? How do they get billed for the service? How does upgrade work? How does management of that service work? And we'll talk about these things as we go through. But that service experience, all the things that are around the core application, are a huge part of differentiating great cloud solutions from ones that are not, and a huge focus of where we'll spend our time. Most of what we'll talk about this morning is about the service and the service that runs in the cloud. But it doesn't matter if the service is running in the cloud if the user can't see it or touch it. And the important thing to think about for the sort of Microsoft view of the cloud is we usually talk about it in terms of three screens in a cloud. We really focus on what are the range of devices that users want to use and how will those connect with cloud-based services. And when we talk about three screens, normally it's kind of small screen, medium screen, large screen. It's a kind of a common message that we've used for a long time. Small being the phone, medium being your desktop PC. And in the home, the large screen is usually the TV. For us, in the business application space, there's significant work going on in terms of rooms with whole walls that are displays. And so as we think about the evolution of our applications to the cloud, we really think in terms of the small format device being the phone or the tablet or pad, the desktop, as well as the large screen or the wall. And some of the things that we'll think about that are really critical to how we drive this. Number one is that we really are looking for zero or near zero deployment overhead for that device software. So in other words, today, our customers go through a significant amount of work to install software on their client, or they use something like Citrix or Terminal Services to kind of manage that installation. We really are looking for an environment where there's little or nothing that has to be installed on the client, and the customer has an instant experience of connecting to the cloud service. The second thing is that we need to assume that since the service is running in a cloud data center, unless Microsoft is going to let our customers move their desks into our data center, the users will all be remote from the service. They won't be local. And so we should assume that our software, regardless of the device that it's on, is connecting with those services over protocols, simple protocols like HTTP, over networks that have a lot of latency, and over all kinds of firewalls. And just to sort of give an example that kind of makes it clear sort of how critical this is, in a previous life between the ATMs and when I came to Microsoft, I helped build a product that's now SAP's e-sourcing on demand. It was a different company when we built it. But we were a cloud-based product from the beginning. And one of the things that is really cool about that is when you go to a customer site to do a demo, you don't have to come with a truck full of servers in order to go do the demo. You walk in with your browser, you get on the internet, you connect to the service, and you do the demo. And we went to a customer, large entertainment company in the United States with a mouse, a famous mouse. No names, but... we went to set up our demo, and our software was very, very fast. And we went to set up the demo, and it was unusably slow. And we tried to, we looked to understand, after we rescheduled the sales call, we looked to understand why that was. And that customer is very strong on their protection of family and of children. And so their firewall that all of the browsers go through in their building opens up any graphic image that's coming down and looks to see if there are colors that might be flesh tone. And we had a few graphics on our screen, a logo, a couple of separators that set up the navigation area, and that was enough. Every one of those was being opened, and each of the bitmaps was being examined for colors to see if it was appropriate. And that was enough to make the software unusable. That's kind of the world we need to assume. Now, you know, the interesting thing is we did some work. We got rid of all the graphics. Whatever ones we used, like logos, were cached. And it worked better in that environment, but it also worked better and faster everywhere else that we did it. But it is sort of an explanation of the difference in the world. Today, we spend a lot of time telling our customers what their IT infrastructure needs to look like to run our product. In the cloud world, we don't control a lot of the things that sit between our service and the client. And so that connection to the client becomes an enormous part of what we focus on. And I'm sure if you ask Thomas Heilsberg, it's an enormous part of what's keeping him up at night these days with the work that he's doing. It's a huge part of what we'll work on. One of the other things that we are very much focused on as we look at this work is our applications, as we bring them to the cloud, are not just about functionality for our customers, but also functionality for our customers' customers or our customers' suppliers. That we're doing things that help a supplier connect with one of our customers, maybe to respond to an RFP. And as you start to think about the fact that we're not just providing software for our customers, but for their whole ecosystem, we have to understand that there are lots of other devices out there that maybe not running Microsoft Windows and IE9. And so as we think about this environment, everything that we'll do, we will drive and evolve to support a large range of devices cross-platform. And so as we think about the evolution of our clients, at Microsoft, that means a focus on HTML5 technology is the way that we'll drive that. We will always be best on Windows. And so while we'll run on through an HTML5 interface, our focus will be on recognizing when we're on a Windows device and taking advantage of that from the point of view of processor, memory, et cetera, in order to do things to give a richer client experience on those devices. And a big part of what we think about with these is that the traditional experience we've always had, where there's kind of a rectangular frame and our parts exist within that, is that maybe that's not the right model for some of the touch-first devices like pads or like phones or even for the large display walls. And so we'll need to change over time our approach to kind of the sort of core experience that a user deals with on these devices. As we now start to look at the service itself and the work that we need to do to architect the service itself, for me, actually, there's probably a multiple challenge number ones, but for the purpose of this morning, let's say that challenge number one is scale. With the cloud-based service, we're talking about large numbers of users, incredible volumes of data, and particularly with a global service, there's no quiet time. You know, there's no window between midnight and 4 a.m. where you can do things that take time, because midnight to 4 a.m. for somebody is nine o'clock in the morning for somebody else, and there's always people hitting the service. So it kind of changes sort of core assumptions that people have had from on-premise systems, and kind of how do we think differently about scalability. So I'll talk about a few things that we're doing and a few things that are being done in conjunction with the platform as well. So the first thing is, historically, with business applications, when we talk about scale, we're usually talking about a scale-up model. How do I get more users to perform effectively against that single database that I'm pointing at, or against my pool of application servers? And what we really need to do is, you can't just keep thinking about building bigger and bigger servers to handle the load. The scale-up model is not enough for what we try to achieve in the cloud. And we have to switch our perspective to one that's more about scale out. And this is not something we'll do overnight, but it's something that will sort of drive evolution over time. And I'll talk about a couple of different models of scale out that are important and that things that we're looking at. So the first piece is achieving scale out by partitioning the application. In other words, take something that starts as a single monolithic application and begin to think of it instead as a set of services that are operating kind of asynchronous loosely coupled services. And just for one example, I took two pieces of the application, inventory and sales order processing. And today, those exist as part of a single application. How would things look if those were really two separate services that talk to each other through messages? And, you know, just to sort of explain, there's some very hard problems that happen when you do that. It's not just a case of taking the code and putting it in two services and changing things that were method calls to service calls. It's not that easy. But I'll look at sort of one example that kind of illustrates different patterns that need to occur in order to make this kind of thing work. So in some cases in manufacturing environments, when you take an order, we actually reserve inventory against that order. So we make sure at the time we take the order that the inventory exists to fulfill it. We're actually going to reserve that inventory or mark it for the customer for that particular order. And it's pretty straightforward. You start a database transaction. You create the order. You mark the inventory as reserved. You actually, first, within the transaction, you check to make sure that that inventory exists. You mark it as reserved, and then you commit the transaction. And the database guarantees us that either none of those things happen or all of those things happen. Pretty straightforward. I can't do that across the services. I don't have the ability to get that kind of database semantic that I can guarantee consistency across separate services. And so I have to think about it differently. And kind of the way that would look is, and this is one example, but I do something that we typically call a soft reservation. So in other words, I send a message over to the inventory service before I start that transaction to create the order. And I say, if you have this inventory, please mark it as sort of soft reserve for me. And come back and tell me whether that succeeds or fails. And if it succeeds, then I go ahead on my sales service and I create the order. And I also create a message to go back to that inventory service that says, please firm up that soft reservation. Please mark it now as firm. And then I commit that transaction. And then I'm done on that side. On the other end, in the inventory service, again, within a transaction, I take the message off the queue. I process it and mark that inventory as now hard reserved. And then I commit that transaction. And I'm done. And the difference here is there's more steps. It's more complicated. But without having to create a transaction that operates across the two separate services, I've still got that same consistency where I'm never in a situation where part of this can happen and part of it doesn't. I don't have to have complicated logic to sort of unwind part of it if the second half fails. It's really very straightforward. Because I know that I was able to soft reserve that, there's no sort of business problem that can happen to me. It's just a technical issue of getting that message across and changing the reservation from soft to hard. What would happen, for example, if the order doesn't process? What's the difference between the soft reservation? We have some sort of timeout, and that depends on the environment, how quickly that needs to be, where the soft reservation expires. And if that message doesn't come across to make it a hard reservation, I cancel it. And it's very simple, very straightforward. We all see this if you buy tickets online for a concert. If you have a teenage daughter like I do, that's a thing you wind up doing quite a bit. And as you first get presented with the tickets you might get, there's usually a message that says, you have 4 minutes to complete this page. And what happens if you complete it within 4 minutes is those tickets become yours. If you don't, they go back in the pool. Right? And it's exactly this pattern. And they do it that way because how else can they deal at scale with lots of people coming in and trying to reserve tickets against the service in a very short window? There are other patterns. It doesn't always look like this. But there, for every kind of thing that we encounter in the application when it's all together, there are sort of well-known ways that we can map that into a world of separately connected services. This is a pattern that we need to do to drive scale out in the cloud, but it's something that also has lots of other benefits. And it's important to sort of understand this one because when I talk about the next one, it's not exactly that way. But by having separate services, in situations where, say for example, a customer was using our system for order processing, but maybe in one of their factories they had another product. They had a legacy system, and they wanted our order processing to talk to that other product. If we've built our software to work in this way, those kind of integrations are much easier, much easier. In addition, we have the possibility, because these pieces of the application communicate through well-known messages, we can over time get to a world where maybe we release different parts of the application on different schedules. That's not necessarily something we have to do. It becomes possible in this environment. And so this is a very powerful change to the way we think about our software. Just given sort of the context of our products, I think this is something that very definitely applies in the world of AX and might not apply so much in the world of NAV just based on the scale and size of systems that we go after. This is not something we'll do overnight. It's not something we'll do everywhere in the application at once. It's an area where we're looking at sort of kind of simple ways to do this first. So, for example, maybe taking the expense management part of the application and separating it from financials, get people comfortable with the different patterns we need to go through and the changes we need to make, and then extend that to other areas of the application. But this kind of model for scale out will become an important way to think about our applications evolving over time. The next thing that we do is, within a piece of the application, partitioning the way in which we store data. And so there's the term that gets used in the Windows Azure or SQL Azure world is sharding or SQL Azure federations. If we take a look at something like, for example, customers or sales orders, which we would store in a single table, in order to drive scale and scale out, we might actually partition that so that we might store customers separately with customers for one region in one physical database, customers for another region in a separate physical database, et cetera. With sales orders, it might be based on the date that that's done. And so kind of the point that's there is you need some sort of logical reason to partition the data. And different reasons will make sense for different kinds of data. It wouldn't make sense to partition the customers based on the date that you added them to the system. It doesn't really sort of logically help you with how you would deal with those. And so the rules for how you would partition would be different. SQL Azure is introducing support in the platform to make it a bit easier to deal with this kind of thing. They will automatically route a query to all of those databases and put the results back together. So to the application, it looks a lot more like that was still stored in a single database. I would point out that for as long as I can remember, people have been trying to make databases that are distributed in this way behave and look and feel as if they were one. And there's a lot of people have lost a lot of hair, and it's still a very, very, very hard problem. So this is something that has to be done with a lot more caution. And unlike the service decomposition, this is something you do in the cloud because you have to. It really just creates work and makes the problem a bit harder, but without sort of opening up other possibilities the way the service decomposition works. If you think about some of the incredibly large services that we run at scale, like, for example, Bing, they very much depend on architectures like this, where they can spread data out across many, many servers. But they don't have the same kind of queries and the same kind of updates that we need to do in a business application that have the same kind of transactional requirements. And so it's a common cloud pattern for things other than ours. It's something that is very much the center. For us, it's kind of a difficult challenge, but something that we'll have to use where appropriate. The next thing that we talk about and where there has to be great awareness is about state and where the application maintains state. And so if you think about, maybe I have this huge pool of servers in my cloud data center, and if a customer starts a transaction and that interacts with one server, and I maintain state in that server that I need to keep coming back to through multiple trips to process that customer's transaction, It really doesn't matter how big my server pool anymore is. As far as that customer is concerned, it's just the one. It's just the one that's got the state for my transaction. And for as long as I'm holding that state in that server, I'm chewing up a piece of the capacity of that server. We all know about the same thing because we get the same challenges when we think today about the way we interact with the database. And the more you hold on to database resources, the more difficult it is to achieve scale. State management becomes an incredibly large challenge in terms of how we really keep the cloud elastic the way we want to. There are a number of things that we need to do. The first being really target more complete requests from the client so that you really want to get to the point that each kind of request from a client to the service is enough to do the whole transaction. And that I can then send the next request from that client maybe to a different server in the pool, and that doesn't matter. And so that's one piece of how we change. It changes the way we have our client interact with the service. The next piece would be really being very careful to minimize the state that we hold on to and to isolate that state. And then on top of that, we have services in Azure from something called AppFabric. There's an integrated cache that the platform shares across the entire service pool. So I can have something in my AppFabric cache on one server, and it will be visible automatically to other servers in that pool. And so we need to focus on sort of understanding the state that our services are holding, kind of minimizing that, isolating it, and using services like the AppFabric cache to sort of make that state visible across the pool. And we'll talk more about this later on. This is kind of an interesting one for me, but the whole approach to performance changes a bit as we think about the cloud. And I was part of a conversation a few weeks ago where people were saying, you know, in this new environment where I have these giant cloud data centers with all this capacity, developers aren't going to understand and appreciate performance the way we used to. And I felt like I had suddenly gotten a lot older and turned into my father and, was hearing one of these conversations that said, you know, in the old days when it was really, really hard, we knew all this, you know, I actually knew sort of how many microseconds the CPU took to do things based on how you wrote the code, and that people weren't going to understand that anymore. I think it's actually very, very, it's actually the opposite, and it's very, very, it's going to be very, very interesting to see how people develop. In the on-prem world, you can be doing things in a very, very sloppy fashion. You can be storing data in a sloppy fashion. You can be making extra trips to the database, extra trips to the client. And you really don't know you have a performance problem until you get to that one customer that's got a lot more sales orders or that has a lot more volume between 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock. And all of a sudden there, whatever sloppy thing you were doing explodes. And you have a terrible visible performance problem. In the cloud, yeah, there's a lot more capacity there, but we have a very interesting difference. The cloud infrastructure, there's actual chargebacks. So I have some developers on my team that are doing work on Azure today, and it's great. I don't have to. I get a report every month, which is their Azure bill. And every byte that they're storing in the Azure data center and every message that they're sending back and forth, I get a bill for it. Of course, it's a paper bill. It's pretend. I don't really have to pay it. But that won't be the case with a production service. It's great as a manager. You get instant feedback on whether your team is doing anything or not. If they don't generate a bill one month, then you know that maybe they weren't working so hard. But if you think about what that means about software design, you find out about bad performance behavior in the app way before it shows up at a customer site. Because if there are too many round trips, you're going to get unexpectedly high chargebacks from the data center for what that works. And so it's really very interesting is that even though we have all this capacity there, because we're explicitly charging back for it, we'll get visibility much earlier on in the process about where we have exposure to performance problems. And the statement at the top is quote's been around. It it gets it's not never really clear where it started from. It might have been Lord Kelvin or whatever, but you know that which you measure will improve. You know, and the fact that our operations people will get a bill for how much round trip traffic is going on suggests that we will pay close attention to that in the design process. I can give an example is that Freddie helped us recently and built a Windows Phone app that talked to an Azure service as part of expense management processing for Dynamics AX. And he's storing some data about non-credit card receipts that you enter through your phone. And he's actually storing an image of the receipt that you take with the phone camera. And sort of the normal way that he thought about doing that at first, or we all thought about doing that at first, is I have SQL Azure in the data center. I'm going to put all of that information in SQL Azure. And in an on-premise environment, that's what you would have done. It's just the easiest thing to do. It turns out in the Azure data center, SQL Azure storage is more expensive than Windows Azure Blob storage. And so by putting the image of the receipt in the database, that application was going to cost more to run. And so Freddie split it so that the service stores the data about the receipt in SQL Azure, but the image of the receipt in the Azure Blob store. And so sort of based on the cost of operating the service, there was a different approach to the design. And I think that that's just something nobody would have thought about in the on-prem world. You know, arguably the same thing is true. It would be cheaper to store images in the file system, but we clearly opt to store them in the same database because it's just easier to maintain the transactions in one place. But in the cloud, the economics were different. In order to drive that service at scale, it really affected the way we thought about the design. And I think that that's going to be something that will very much be part of our thinking as we go forward. The next sort of big challenge and the big change around cloud services is manageability. And again, it's sort of the same thing. That which is measured improves. In the cloud, guess who's running the service? Is we are. If there's a problem with running that service, or if there's a problem with finding problems when that service breaks down, if there's a problem with upgrading that service, it's not our customers' IT people that are going to be doing that. It's going to be our people. And I assure you, if there are challenges, there will be great visibility about that. And so it's a real change in terms of how we build manageable software. A few things to think about. One is we very much want to focus on our customers having a one Microsoft experience in the cloud. And what we mean by that is we hope that they're not just buying Dynamics in the cloud, but that they're also buying Office 365 from us in the cloud, that they're buying Exchange in the cloud, that maybe they're doing custom development on Azure in the cloud. And we really want the opportunity to give them a one Microsoft experience. It's something we've worked hard at in the on-prem world. It's almost more critical in the cloud world. So, for example, the way they sign up for services, they should be able to sign up for them in the same way. It should look familiar. The way that those services get managed should be the same. The policies around upgrade should be the same. They should be consistent. The way they find out about outages should be consistent. And so, you know, I'll talk a little bit sort of about the work that we're doing in that area. If you look at the sign-up experience, and I described it earlier for CRM, it's incredibly easy for somebody to go sign up and try that product. And we really, really like that because we feel like when customers get their hands on our products, we win. And so the easier we can make that first experience to say, hey, I want to try it, that's great. If you look instead at the Office 365 products and SharePoint and things like that online, what we've built is a great IT experience that when the CIO decides, yes, I want to buy all my productivity services from Microsoft, they can sign the company up. They can connect their Active Directory and federate users very effectively. And so the go-to-production experience is really done quite well on the Office side. And what we want to do for sort of that one Microsoft experience is we want both of those. We want the quick trial experience. We want the unified production experience where I can sign up for all the Microsoft services I want, sort of all done in the same way. And so we're working together with the team that drives how you sign up for the Office Productivity Services to make sure that we can provision Dynamics CRM and in the future Dynamics ERP through the same mechanisms. The customer has taken an enormous jump by entrusting us to run their business applications. And with that comes the need for them to have a very simple way to go get a sort of management experience of their world, not our servers, but their world, their ERP application on our servers, but uptime. Were there errors? Are there planned outages? When will upgrade occur? And sort of having a very single portal that they can go to for all of their Microsoft services in the cloud. And one of the things that we think about is there's actually kind of a new complexity in sort of how you log and track error events for this kind of management environment. In the on-premise world, it's oversimplifying a little bit, but you sort of had messages that were for IT and messages that were for users. And so if an error occurred, you kind of had to think about, how do I report this to the user? Or if it's not something the user can deal with, if it needs to go to IT, what's the mechanism by which I log errors that go to IT? In the cloud, it's kind of different. There's a third category. There's still some things that the user deals with. There's some things that go to the IT team that actually runs the service. But there's a third group that actually need to go to sort of the IT administration at that customer. So, for example, one of the things with SQL Azure is you buy capacity in chunks. And if you're sort of running low on that, it's your IT people that need to know you need to increase the amount of storage you need to pay for. On the other hand, if there's a problem reaching the directory service, a cloud customer wouldn't even know where to go to look at that. And so that needs to go to the cloud administration people. And so there'll be a whole new set of kind of platform services and APIs for error reporting. And associated with that new, what we call common engineering criteria across Microsoft products, so that we do that in a consistent way across all our cloud services. The thing about management of the service is the ability to cost-effectively manage each tenant, each customer's view of the world, is really the biggest determinant to how much it costs to run that service. It's not the cost of hardware, but it's the cost of people to manage and keep a service running that really determines whether you can run that at an effective cost and run it profitably. And so we will have an increased focus on the manageability of the software that we write and the ability to quickly identify issues, report them to the right people, and then drive the resolution. It's not, the cloud service is not something that somebody can just walk up and attach a debugger to. And we need to think about those things differently as we build it and build in the reporting and manageability to help us keep the system up and running most effectively. One of the unique things about Microsoft is the work that we're doing around the way customers will really deal with this, which is they won't be all on-premise one day and then go home for the weekend and come in on Monday and all their stuff's running in the cloud. It doesn't happen that way. But our customers will deal with a hybrid environment of a combination of on-premise software and cloud software for a long time to come. This is not something that just sort of will be around for 6 months or a year. This will be the reality for a long time to come, either because customers have legacy systems that won't ever go to the cloud but that their business is bet on, that maybe for regulatory reasons they can't put certain data in the cloud and they'll want to keep that on-premise, that maybe as they acquire other businesses or are in fact consolidated, that you'll wind up needing to combine with systems that already exist and were on-premise. And as we think in the future over time, I think that we'll go beyond the idea of services that run entirely in the cloud and just communicate with devices. But we'll have a combination of services that are in the cloud working with appliances that are on-premise to provide local capability and caching and speed and reliability. And so that combination of on-premise and cloud is actually the reality for a long time to come. Two big things that will be important in this area, and two big things that Microsoft is doing a significant amount of platform work that we can build on, is first the idea of identity. So knowing who the user is in a seamless way across on-premise systems and the cloud. That's an area that is very much changing today. If you look at what we've done with Dynamics CRM Online, when Dynamics CRM is on-premise, we use Windows Authentication the same way we do with our ERP products. When it's running online in the cloud, we use Windows Live ID because that was the cloud-based identity system that we have. As things evolve, Windows Live ID is really becoming focused on the consumer experience. Me as a consumer, my private access to web services. In the business environment, there will be a corresponding service, I believe now called Microsoft Online ID, that represents business-related credentials of mine, but available in the cloud. So think about it as kind of the analogous thing to Active Directory, but cloud-based. And the things that Microsoft is doing, which we can build off of, is providing the federation or the connection between an on-premise Active Directory and the Microsoft Online ID that runs in the cloud. So that I can have one set of credentials as a business user, and I can connect to my on-premise applications, and I can connect to my online applications in a straightforward sort of single sign-on kind of way. And from a security point of view, more importantly, if for some reason I leave a company and my credentials are turned off, they're turned off across both of those worlds at the same time and with one action. So big change in identity, and it will mean using the Azure identity services for us, but gives us the advantage of having two credential systems that work together on-premise and in the cloud. And together with that, secure networking capability that allows us to connect between on-premise world and the cloud world. And in fact, technology to help us connect scenarios that run across those environments. And that technology is the Azure Service Bus. And as an example, today, for our customers that use CRM, much of the customization that occurs in CRM happens through an eventing model. And we've provided the ability to propagate events from the service into the Azure environment over the service bus so that I can actually write my customization running in Azure and have the full availability of that cloud capability to handle events and yet seamlessly connected to my application, which is running elsewhere. Speaking of customization, it has always been one of the strengths of our products, and it's an area which will get even better in the cloud. And the big push for us here has to be the focus on model-driven, declarative customization. By being model-driven and in contrast to achieving customization by writing code, it's simpler for our customers to do. But more importantly, it gives us the opportunity to upgrade. So in other words, I don't have to go look at code that a customer has changed and run diffs and sort of help them understand how to move that code forward. If I've done customization in a model-driven way, then we can generally upgrade those models from release to release. And it means that the code that customer is running is the same as code that other customers are running. And so that I have the ability to share that code across multiple instances of the service. Be very, very clear about this. This is what we do today with Dynamics CRM Online. So the customization that we enable in that environment is all declarative. And it's either done through models in the system or by subscribing to events and making the connection to code that's run elsewhere. And so every customer runs against the same copy of the code, and yet their customization is all reflected in metadata in models. And not only does it make it easier for them to do, but it makes it possible for us to upgrade from release to release and preserve their customization. The next thing is kind of the way in which we customize schema and the way in which we customize service interfaces will both have to change in this environment. Today, when we customize schema, when somebody wants to add fields to the customer table, we add fields to the customer table. And that means my customer table is different from Michael's customer table. And that's not a good model for trying to run a service in the cloud. We want to keep the core schema consistent and join two other tables that reflect my schema customization. And again, this is something we already do in the CRM environment. This is not something that is sort of a theoretical possibility. It's something we've done and we understand how to do. And again, it simplifies the upgrade. In the case of having service interfaces that work this way, where they share the same common schema and we deal with customization in a different way, then it's much easier to drive scenarios around B2B integration where they just have to work at the level of that common schema. This is a core piece where we really have learned from Dynamics CRM Online. I will point out to the one of the things that we did there is the CRM product on-premise had customization options that we were not able to make declarative up at first. And what we did is we turned those off. Is we chose to restrict customization a bit in order to guarantee the upgradability of the service. And then as we developed ways to address those kinds of customizations, we turned them back on. And that will need to be the same approach, is that the upgradability is something we can't compromise on. And so we will have to sort of tune down customization for a time in order to guarantee the upgradability. And finally, the other piece around the customization is not only do our customers customize, but our ISVs customize, and they build extensions to the system. Not only do we give them these new ways to build them, but in the online environment, one of the things we want to drive in terms of that same concept of time to value is how can we make it easier for customers to find those ISV solutions? How can we make it easier for them to add those to what they're subscribing to, pay for them, and get them deployed? And the Dynamics Marketplace, again, something we put in place with CRM, will be the same vehicle that we'll use to drive that for ERP. There's a few other considerations, and kind of most of these we've touched on, but I just want to make sure to sort of cover them quickly. The first is simplicity. The customers place a real premium on simplicity in the cloud. And that doesn't mean lack of capability. You can still be rich, but it needs to be simpler for people to understand how to do things, how to get started with the system. Things that they, as they use the system, need to be easier. We've already talked quite a bit about how customization and upgrade need to be easier. And the core thing with simplicity in software, and I think we did a great job in the last version of Dynamics AX, that we always do a great job in Dynamics NAV. Simplicity in software surely does not happen by itself. If you have a lot of people adding capability to software, the unfortunate natural behavior is that the software gets more complicated. And software only gets simple if you decide that that's important to you and if you decide to make simplicity a job. You know, I remember as we, at the beginning of the last of the AX 2012 development cycle, we told our program managers on a number of the teams that simplicity was important. The first thing they did is they came back with a list of all the things they were going to add to the product for simplicity. We said, that's interesting, but I really need to see instead what are the things that are going to go away? What are the steps that users don't really need to do that we can make go away? What are the extra fields that are getting in users' ways that we can take away? This is something, and it's also a job that you don't finish in one release. It's a job that's there forever, which is we need to focus all the time on making the software simpler. That's the case on-premise. But it's even more true in the cloud. It's what the users expect in the cloud. Privacy and data security, that's always been a concern for us, but it's raised up to a new level. Honestly, I'm not sure what the situation's been like in Europe over the last month, but over the last month in the United States, the number of, I actually received within 1 week, I received letters from 30 different places that I do business with that apologize for the fact that the marketing service they use had their email list compromised, and that I really didn't need to worry about anything because they didn't get any real data about me. But every credit card company, every bank, every brokerage house, several online merchants, all working through the same online marketing service, reported that their data had been compromised. PlayStation, with their online gaming environment, just suffered a very significant privacy break that's actually taken their service offline. None of us want to read about our applications on the front page of the paper as the target of a security or privacy breach. And so while that's always been an area of excellence for us, and clearly the work that we do around threat modeling, et cetera, the stakes are higher in the cloud. And particularly with ERP, and it's very interesting to me, with CRM, if I were a business and somebody asked me where my security concern was about maybe running CRM in the cloud or running ERP in the cloud, CRM systems got all my prospects, all my opportunities. I'd be pretty worried about that. That's enormously valuable to my competitors versus maybe what's in what GL account, probably not the most interesting thing for somebody to go snoop in. And I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it's interesting. We receive almost no pushback whatsoever about data security, except for certain industries, about CRM in the cloud. But when we talk to customers and prospects that are resistant to putting ERP in the cloud, the first thing that comes up is security, is I'm not sure I want my financial data up there. And so the premium for us, not just in terms of it's the right way to build software for this environment, but it actually affects the selling process and the ability to talk about and with strength about what we've done to engineer for security and for privacy is enormously important. The last one is kind of probably worth two or three talks on its own. But, you know, in the on-premise world, we've sort of been trained to build software and try to make it resistant to failure, trying to make sure that that we do everything we can to keep components up for the longest period of time, we stress test, et cetera. That's still something we worry about in the cloud, but the perspective changes. And if you read a number of things about the Azure environment and most of the sort of large-scale cloud environments, you shift from a model of trying to engineer to avoid failure to engineering in a world where you assume failure. There are so many nodes in that system, you have to assume that boxes will fail. Our whole data center architecture is based on the idea that we have containers full of CPUs. Eventually, they fail enough that we turn off the container and replace it. And so the model changes. I don't go in and repair it anymore. I just wait till enough of them fail and I replace it. It's the whole sort of core architecture in Azure. Azure runs, for every piece of data that we store in SQL Azure, Azure automatically stores three copies. If one of those copies fails, it automatically spins up the third one and catches up to the point that it keeps three copies. And the assumption is that a node is going to fail and that you have to recover around that. And this sort of gets back to the conversation we had about state, is if I'm maintaining a lot of state in my service, the ability to spin up another copy and catch up means I have to recover all of that state. And so the whole sort of model changes into the way we think about pieces failing. We should assume they're going to fail. The design paradigm is one where we focus on operating in an environment where pieces are failing all the time, and yet to the outside, the fabric of the service keeps working. One of the things that's really important is because, you know, we have loads and loads of customers that that have bought our products and do incredibly well with our products on-premise today. And we're talking a lot about the cloud and what we're going to do to engineer in our next releases for the cloud, the cloud, the cloud, the cloud. One of the things that's really important to understand is everything that I talked about and everything that we're really doing in order to drive for great cloud products actually accrues benefits to our on-prem customers. And I'll just talk about one example, but I think you could sort of you can go through and you can see it with all of them. If I just simply talk about the client and all the things that we're doing to have the client work over slow networks and to have the client work with no deployment, the vast majority of our on-premise customers use terminal services or app virtualization or Citrix because they don't want to manage the installation of the client, or they don't want to worry about how the client performs when the network is slow. This new client, which, by the way, cross-platform, running on multiple devices, understanding phones, understanding big wall-sized displays, and having no deployment cost, and running across every kind of network latency and firewall, just makes their life easier. Right? And I think you can look through all the things we talk about in terms of scale, in terms of performance, in terms of customization, in terms of simplicity, manageability, upgradability. Do you think our on-premise customers would like it if software just sort of upgraded itself when the new release came out? So all this work that we're doing, it's kind of stuff that you have to do in the cloud. It's imperative in the cloud. But it'll pay enormous dividends and really change the game in terms of the way people perceive our on-premise products. Finally, the last thing that I want to talk about is sort of all these things are about, all the things we've talked about are how do we build our existing apps differently. But I want to talk about sort of three examples really quickly of kind of problems that we just, they become different in the cloud. They're much easier or even for the first time possible in the cloud. And we really look at them in sort of three patterns. One is kind of shared data. The second, kind of connections and a connected supply chain. And finally, sort of big data analytics across those pieces. So very, very quickly, you look at the shared data piece. We have a partner today, an AX partner, that produces a product compliance application. Their software is not particularly magical, but what's magical is the data that they understand. They understand every law in every country about what ingredients you can ship to that country or not ship to that country, and if you do ship to that country, what documentation needs to be there or who needs to get paid in order to make that possible. And they have an on-premise product today, and every 3 to 6 months they update that database and they ship it out to all their customers. And their customers have to install that. Everybody's looking at the same data. The rules are the same for everybody. There's no value that's added by each person having and maintaining their own copy. This is just something where the economics work better if there's one copy of that running in a service in the cloud that everybody integrates to. That way, it can be upgraded whenever it needs to be. People are instantly compliant. It's just a model that works better. So any of these situations where you have a large amount of data, and that data is valuable, it's volatile, and everybody wants the same data, or large groups of customers want the same data, the cloud just gives us a different way to do that. And so thinking about things related to payroll regulations, to tax, to compliance, any of those sort of business application problems, the cloud gives us a different way to do it. The second piece is sort of, how do we connect big supply chains? And if you have a number of people connected in a supply chain, if you thought that they were each going to make electronic connections between their systems point to point individually, it very, very quickly explodes into an unbelievable number of interfaces that need to be supported. If instead each of those people talked to one cloud-based hub and everything went through the cloud-based hub, it's still an incredibly hard problem. But at least the number of connections is possible. And more importantly, for many of these supply chains, there are security issues and there's privacy issues about what data do I want to share with whom and what data do I not want to share. And we're doing work with a very large retailer. And those retailers, they know about their suppliers. Their suppliers really have two missions. One is to make money, taking care of their customer. And number two is not to let the customer know who their suppliers are, who's behind the first level of suppliers. Because the first thing that customer will do is cut the first guy out and deal direct with the guy behind him. And so what the customer is after is they're looking at trying to build information that they can put on products on the shelf in their store that show the full environmental impact of what it took to put that product on the shelf. So you know when you're buying it, not only what did it cost, but what was the environmental impact of producing it and getting it to the store. In order to do that, they need data all up and down that supply chain. And yet their suppliers don't even want them to know who's behind them in the supply chain. If you have a hub in the middle, that hub can understand how to take information and share it up without disclosing the identity of who it came from. And so, again, it still remains an enormously hard problem to solve, but it's one where the ability to put hubs in the cloud give us the ability to solve those in ways we haven't done it before. We've got a number of projects like this that are underway, and they sort of go beyond what we've typically addressed with our core applications, although they provide a great point for our applications to connect to as we look at the cloud as a way to change the way we look at supply chains. And the final thing is, if I have all that data flowing through the cloud that previously was never in one place before, I can start to do analytics against that, and I can start to understand trends that may not have been visible before or would have taken a much longer time to be visible. And so, you know, I'll give an example here that's not a supply chain example, but it's one that's very easy to understand. A little over a year ago, there was a huge flu epidemic. And people were able to understand that they could look at who was querying their favorite search engine, whichever that was, for symptoms like headache and fever and nausea. And you could look at the IP addresses where those queries were coming from and understand where the flu was. And you could understand where the flu was before those people even went to their doctor, before the doctor told the public health authority, and before the public health authority published their analysis. And there was no violation of privacy. Nobody knew that Mike and his two kids and the dog all had the flu. They just knew there were a lot of people in Seattle that were issuing queries. And so this data, which never existed in one place before, here kind of in a sort of funny way, people discovered it. But you were able to see the trend in a way that was much more visible, much more quickly, and all without sort of violating privacy. And so thinking about the cloud hubs and the ability to connect businesses and then to do analytics across that data really opens up a whole new set of challenges for us to look at that the cloud makes possible. So we have a lot to do to sort of bring our solutions to the cloud. But we also get the opportunity to think about new and different things where we can where we can thrill our customers with different solutions. So that's really it for me. I'm not sure if we have time for questions. We might be able to take one or two. But otherwise, that's it. Yep. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last. Yeah, there are a number of those things. And it's actually interesting for me is, and the question was, we talk about concerns about security and privacy slowing people going to the cloud. Are there places where we've been able to overcome that and actually get the customers to move? It's actually pretty interesting for me because one of the things that is very clear to me is that except for our biggest customers, the protection that they will have for their data, both from a security point of view, but a backup and failover and disaster recovery point of view, will be much better in our environment than what they're actually doing for themselves. And yet, they're not aware of that. You know, you're typically not aware of your exposure until something happens and you get to figure out that you can't recover. So it's hard, it's a little bit odd because I think we're going to be doing a better job for them in almost every case except for the sort of biggest and largest customers, will be doing a better job than what they do, and yet they still have these concerns. Parts of the ways that those get overcome is that we actually there are actually authorities that audit the security of data centers, and there are published standards. And so we actually get our environments audited and certified according to those, and then we sort of make that part of the way we talk about it, and you get the customer to start asking the questions, well, are we already at that level or not? And so you get, you know, you make it a strength, and then you make it part of the conversation. One of the things that's true is there are certain places where either we're largely because of the industry regulations in a particular industry, the public cloud may not be a possibility. So, for example, a lot of things about healthcare data in the United States can't be stored in the public cloud. And so, for those kind of things, the ability to deliver our solutions in a private cloud version, hosted by a partner, is the other way that we address that. And so, for example, we have a number of things throughout the world with Accenture hosting our products for healthcare for that reason. Yep. So the question was, do we run into issues where it's actually the challenge is when the rules in one country actually conflict with the other. You know, one model would be we could just build to the strongest requirement of any country and then deploy that everywhere. And unfortunately, you can't do that because there are places where certain things must be stored at least in country or on premise, depending on regulation, and other ones need to be stored in the cloud. And that's, yes, we run into that. Employee data is, in fact, part of that. And sort of partitioning the data and thinking about federating that data so that part of it's stored elsewhere is really, that kind of using that same example we had about partitioning data, but doing it sort of based on the privacy rules is really the only answer to that. It's just a hard problem. There's no easy answer. Yep. Yeah. So it's a great question. How are we doing compared to the competitors? I'm going to watch the clock a little bit because we had to do that. But the short answer is quite well. If you look in particular at our Dynamics CRM today online, a number of the older competitors in that space are really not a factor anymore at all, people like Siebel. Compared to the other leading cloud competitors, somebody like Salesforce, for example, which really is sort of the leader in that space, all the recent evaluations by people like Forrester and Gartner that look at the depth of the application absolutely talk very, very strongly about they put us up in the leader space in that area. So great project progress that way. Things like, for example, what we've done with having Outlook be the primary client for that service application, that's enormously important to the users of those things. And so we actually have a number of advantages. Our customization and partner development story around that, very, very strong competitively. They're still bigger, but the growth in the business suggests we're doing quite well. One last one? Yeah.
Many people would be afraid of data over. I think people would like to say that if you publish more about that on your website, but you're saying that on-premise you have permission to, or on-premise you have at least state that you can go back to some state and recover. You're not very
No, I completely agree with you. I think it's the same thing as what we talked about earlier in terms of how you sort of talk about your privacy and security results and what audits you subject yourself to and pass, and you make it part of the conversation. And we need to do the same thing about the failover and recovery. The interesting thing is, and I've been, you know, it's running software development groups, you know, our source code control system is effectively that same sort of critical data that we're talking about here. And I've worked in many places where they held up the backup tapes and said, see, we're okay. because we do a backup every Friday night. And one of the things that I did is I came in and said, you know what, next Monday to the IT team, you guys are supposed to pretend that our building is gone. And you take your tapes and you go to our alternate IT facility and you call me when I can send the developers over. And days, weeks, let's try another backup. Until you actually restore, until you really have to deal with it, you don't know. And I agree with you. I think that we'll be able to kind of do those things and make it part of the conversation. And I think when we make it part of the conversation, it'll change people's perspective. Okay, that's it. Thanks, guys.